Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Last time on Solving JFK, we got to know the basics about Guy Bannister, a former FBI agent and extreme anti-communist who had a detective agency in New Orleans but didn't take any standard detective agency work. Instead, Bannister appeared to be wrapped up in anti-Castro activities. Witnesses who worked with Bannister said that he had high connections at both the FBI and the CIA. In this episode, we look at the relationship, or lack thereof, between Guy Bannister and Lee Harvey Oswald. Did Oswald ever do any work for Bannister? And is it true that Oswald had an office at 544 Camp Street, which was in the same building as Guy Bannister's detective agency? And what are we to make of the Fair Play for Cuba materials that Oswald had stamped 544 Camp Street?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a part of the
man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. The first big question that we have to answer is whether Guy Bannister knew Lee Harvey Oswald at all. If so, what was the nature of their relationship? In the next episode, we'll be covering the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, known as the FPCC, and Oswald's relationship with it in depth. For now, what you need to know is that Oswald was handing out FPCC materials on the street in New Orleans on multiple occasions during the summer of 1963. Given Guy Bannister's obsession with overthrowing Castro, the security work that Bannister did on behalf of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, and the fact that he kept files on communist sympathizers, it's not surprising that Guy Bannister would be aware of Oswald. The real question is whether Bannister and Oswald actually had a relationship. Of course, if they did, that relationship would severely undercut the argument that Oswald was a communist and would support the idea that Oswald was some sort of agent since he was actively portraying himself as a Castro supporter, but hanging out with or working on behalf of someone who was intensely anti-Castro. The House Select Committee on Assassinations actually looked at this question. Relying on the testimony of Ross Bannister, Guy's brother, and former Bannister investigator Ivan Nitschke, the HSCA determined, quote, "Witnesses interviewed by the committee indicate Bannister was aware of Oswald and his Fair Play for Cuba committee before the assassination. Nitschke said that Bannister was, quote, interested in Oswald in the summer of 1963, and that Bannister had some of these FPCC handbills that Oswald had passed out in his office. This idea of Bannister at least knowing who Oswald was and what he was up to is confirmed by Lee Harvey Oswald's name being found among Guy Bannister's FPCC files as one of the main subjects. Louisiana State Police Officer Joseph Cambra witnessed this file and told the HSCA about it. But the HSCA didn't give Cambra's testimony any credence, concluding, quote, the committee could find no documentary proof that Bannister had a file on Lee Harvey Oswald, nor could the committee find credible witnesses who ever saw Lee Harvey Oswald and Guy Bannister together. No one ever got around to asking Guy Bannister himself about his relationship with Oswald, because Bannister died, apparently from a heart attack, in June of 1964, 3 months before the Warren Report was released to the public. Despite the HSCA's finding that there was no relationship between Oswald and Bannister, there are numerous witnesses who disagree with that assessment and instead say that Guy Bannister did know Lee Harvey Oswald. Let's start with Delphine Roberts and Jack Martin, the two witnesses who put Oswald and Bannister's office together, but whose testimony the HSCA then dismissed as not being credible. Delphine Roberts was Guy Bannister's secretary at his detective agency during the summer of 1963. Her right-wing politics very much aligned with Bannister. For example, she picketed the Catholic Church over desegregation in April of 1962. She met Bannister later that year when she was protesting that the American flag wasn't getting enough respect. From that interaction, Bannister hired Delphine Roberts as his secretary. Roberts, who became Bannister's mistress in addition to being his secretary, told HSCA investigators that Lee Harvey Oswald walked into Bannister's office sometime in May of 1963 and was given an employment application. She said that Oswald came to Bannister's office many times during the summer of 1963, and that he and Bannister were on familiar terms. When Delphine Roberts spoke to the HSCA, she didn't mention anything about seeing Oswald in her first HSCA interview. She also failed to mention Oswald in her interview with Jim Garrison's investigators in 1967. She did bring up seeing Oswald in Bannister's office on several occasions in her second HSCA interview. Because of these inconsistencies, the HSCA found that, quote, the reliability of Robert's statements could not be determined. Jack Martin, one of Guy Bannister's investigators, also told the HSCA that he saw Lee Harvey Oswald in Bannister's office in 1963. Martin said that he saw Oswald and Bannister in the office with David Ferry. This is the same story that Martin told New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. In a December 26, 1966 affidavit to Garrison's office, Martin said, quote, in the late summer of 1963, I was sitting in the office of Guy Bannister. David Ferry walked in wearing an army-type fatigue suit and sunglasses. Also with him were three or four young men in their 20s dressed in sports shirts. One of them was Morris Brownlee, another one was a man they referred to as Lee. After the assassination, I recognized Lee Harvey Oswald as one of the men who had walked in with Ferry and Brownlee. All of them went in to see Bannister and the door was shut, so I wouldn't know what they talked about. These people, before seeing Bannister, sat around in the waiting room for 15 or 20 minutes, occasionally picking up magazines to look at. I looked at them frequently because I thought this was a rather odd assortment of people. Jack Martin is referring to a specific instance when Oswald came in and, according to him, he got a good look at Oswald and the other guys. Martin tells the same story to Jim Garrison and to the HSCA, but ultimately the HSCA dismissed Martin seeing Oswald in Bannister's office because Martin never mentioned seeing Oswald in Bannister's office when he spoke to the FBI shortly after the assassination in 1963. The HSCA found that, quote, in light of Martin's previous contradictory statements to authorities shortly after the assassination, in which Martin made no such allegation about having seen Oswald, it may be argued that credence should not be placed in Martin's statements to the committee. In addition to these inconsistent statements, Jack Martin was also notorious for having a drinking problem. I understand the reasons to not believe Jack Martin about seeing Oswald in Bannister's office. But the question is, if Martin did see Oswald in Bannister's office, would he have any reasons to not tell the FBI that information? I could see Martin being afraid to talk about Bannister's ties to Oswald if they existed, because he may have thought that it wasn't safe to share and that it would implicate Bannister. Martin's initial allegations to the FBI were all about David Ferry, who Martin did not like after they had a falling out that was related to Carlos Marcello's attorney, G. Ray Gill, not wanting Martin hanging around the office. David Ferry worked as a private investigator for Gill in addition to regularly meeting with Guy Bannister about anti-Castro activities. So while I'm not sure where I land on the credibility of Jack Martin, I think it's possible that the reason that Martin waited until Guy Bannister was dead to come forward with the information about Oswald working with Bannister could very well have been because Martin wanted to protect Bannister from the exposure of explosive information related to Lee Harvey Oswald. We'll come back to the question of whether Oswald was seen in Bannister's office momentarily. But first, we need to take a quick detour as it relates to Jack Martin. I can't just mention Jack Martin as a witness to whether Oswald was in Bannister's office without covering the main reason why Jack Martin is so well known. Martin is the one who was hanging out with Guy Bannister in a bar on the night President Kennedy was assassinated. According to what Martin told the HSCA, he and Bannister got into a fight at the bar and returned to Bannister's office. At that point, in response to something Bannister said to Martin, Martin then said to Bannister, quote, "What are you going to do, kill me like you all did Kennedy?" That led to Bannister pistol whipping Martin with his .357 Magnum. Martin said that Bannister might have killed him if it wasn't for Delphine Roberts pleading for Bannister to stop. This scene was captured in Oliver Stone's film JFK, with Ed Asner playing Bannister and Jack Lemmon playing Jack Martin. There's no dispute that this incident of Guy Bannister pistol-whipping Jack Martin really did happen. The question is whether this fight was really about the Kennedy assassination, as Martin alleged, or whether it was about something else. Martin filed a police report after Bannister assaulted him with the revolver, and in that police report, which was on the night of the assassination, it doesn't say anything about Martin seeing Oswald in the office. The report says that the fight was over personal and political subjects and Jack Martin making unauthorized long-distance phone calls. Martin's initial police report on the night of the assassination doesn't mention anything at all about President Kennedy. While it sounds ridiculous on its face that Bannister would pistol whip Martin over long-distance phone calls, there is some support for the idea that Martin told people that. First, it is possible that Bannister could have just gone off for a small reason or no reason at all because Bannister was very quick to anger. Remember, he was fired from the New Orleans police for getting into a fight with a bartender. But we don't know that Bannister's general anger management problems were the reason for the fight in this case. There's also a statement that David Ferry gave to the FBI in December of 1963, where he told them that Martin was making long-distance phone calls and charging them to Bannister's office and to G. Ray Gill's office, where David Ferry also worked. Bannister investigator Joseph Newbro told the HSCA that Martin told him the reason for the fight with Bannister was over long-distance phone calls. However, Newbro didn't believe Martin. According to the HSCA report, Newbro, quote, believed that Bannister pistol-whipping Martin was over something more serious than that. According to Delphine Roberts, another possible reason for the altercation is that Bannister thought that Martin was stealing files from his office. She told the HSCA that Martin came into the office and approached the area where the files are kept. When Bannister walked in, he accused Martin of stealing several files and hiding them in his coat. Then, according to Roberts, Bannister hit Martin in the head with the gun after Martin said that he didn't steal any files. We'll never know definitively what the Bannister-Martin pistol-whipping incident was really about, but the possibilities are unauthorized long-distance phone usage, stealing files, or the assassination of President Kennedy. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Hey everybody, Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount. We've covered Delphine Roberts and Jack Martin, the two witnesses who told the HSCA that they remember seeing Oswald in Bannister's office, but whom the HSCA did not find reliable. But is there anyone else who claims that Oswald personally knew Bannister? Sometime in May of 1963, Michael Kurtz attended an informal meeting at Louisiana State University where he says Guy Bannister debated students about integration. Kurtz recalled that Bannister was accompanied by a young man that he introduced as Lee Oswald. Oswald said nothing during the meeting. Kurtz, who is now a history professor emeritus at Southeastern Louisiana State University, says that he later saw Oswald eating with Guy Bannister at Mancuso's restaurant, which was next door to Bannister's office. That's consistent with what Adrian Alba said. Alba, who owned the garage where Oswald would always hang out when he worked at Riley Coffee Company, said that he often saw Oswald eating lunch alone at Mancuso's. On the other hand, the owner of Mancuso's restaurant told the HSCA that he always saw Bannister, David Ferry, and Jack Martin together, but he couldn't remember ever personally seeing Oswald there. It's not just Delphine Roberts, Jack Martin, and Michael Kurtz who say that Oswald was with Bannister. We would expect there to be more witnesses who saw Oswald in Bannister's office if Oswald really did work for or have a relationship with Bannister. And it turns out there are several more witnesses who have something to say on the topic. Vernon Gerdes, who worked for Bannister, later worked for attorney Stephen Plotkin and told Plotkin that he saw Oswald together with David Ferry and Guy Bannister. Tommy Baumler was a student who worked with Bannister to infiltrate left-wing college groups. Baumler told researcher Bud Fensterwald that there was no doubt that Oswald worked for Bannister. David Lewis, another former Bannister investigator, says that he didn't see Oswald with Bannister, but he did see Oswald eating lunch at Mancuso's restaurant with Bannister's close associate and local Cuban exile leader, Sergio Arcacha Smith. There's also the testimony of William Gaudette, who worked for the CIA for many years. Gaudette once saw Oswald speaking to Guy Bannister in front of the International Trade Mart, where Gaudette had an office. Gaudette said, quote, "I saw Bannister in deep conversation with Lee Harvey Oswald on Camp Street right by the post office box. They were leaning over and talking, and it was an earnest conversation. What it was, I don't know." When Gaudette was asked if it looked like they knew one another, he said, quote, "Obviously. They didn't seem to be strangers talking on the street. It seemed to Gaudette that Bannister, quote, wanted Oswald to do something." What's interesting, or perhaps revealing, depending on how you view the case, is that the HSCA did find William Gaudette to be credible. They relied on Gaudette as a witness for the subject of Oswald's time in Mexico City. But the HSCA didn't even mention Gaudette's testimony about Oswald talking to Bannister at all, even though they covered the topic when they interviewed him. The omission of Gaudette's testimony raises the question of whether it was an honest mistake or whether his story was swept under the rug. We just covered seven witnesses who claimed to have seen Oswald speaking to Guy Bannister directly. But the most famous connection that Oswald has to Bannister is the 544 Camp Street stamp that was placed on some of his FPCC handouts. Bannister's office was located at 531 Lafayette Street on the first floor of the building. 544 Camp Street was the address for the second floor offices of that very same building, which had a different entrance. The building was on the corner of Camp and Lafayette. It's not disputed that Oswald handed out some printed materials that were stamped with 544 Camp Street. However, there is intense disagreement about the meaning of Oswald's 544 Camp Street stamp. To the defenders of the Warren Report, it's a red herring coincidence that can be explained away. To Warren Report critics, the 544 Camp Street stamp is a direct link that connects Oswald with Guy Bannister. So did Lee Harvey Oswald have an office at 544 Camp Street? Let's hear what the witnesses have to say. We heard from Delphine Roberts about Oswald's relationship with Bannister, but she also told author Anthony Summers that Oswald had the use of an office upstairs on the second floor, which is consistent with the 544 Camp Street address. Mary Bringle, who did part-time work for Bannister, said that Delphine Roberts told her 2 weeks after the assassination that Oswald had been in Bannister's office. Delphine Roberts' daughter, whose name was also Delphine, said that one time Bannister showed her the upstairs offices and she saw leaflets and placards related to Fair Play for Cuba. And her claim is supported by another one of Bannister's investigators, Bill Nitschke, who saw the same materials in a second floor office that had something to do with Castro. Consuela Martin also worked part-time for Guy Bannister as a Spanish translator. She told Professor Michael Kurtz that Oswald came to see her more than once to drop off things to be translated. Consuela Martin thought that Oswald was trying to locate pro-Castro sympathizers for Bannister because Oswald's documents were all pro-Castro, and she knew that Bannister hated Fidel. Dan Campbell, like Tommy Baumler, was another young man who Bannister used to infiltrate leftist student groups. Campbell told author James D. Eugenio that he recalled seeing Oswald come in to use the phone at Bannister's office on one occasion. So far, that is 10 people who said that they saw Oswald at Bannister's office. Eventually, Guy Bannister found out that Oswald was using a stamp with 544 Camp Street for his Fair Play for Cuba handouts. According to Delphine Roberts, Bannister was not very happy when he found out. She told the HSCA that Bannister yelled at Sam Newman, the building owner, and at James Arthas, the building custodian. He was mad that they let Oswald use a room on the second floor without being supervised. How's it gonna look for him to have the same address as me? Alan Campbell, who worked for Bannister along with his brother Dan, said that on one occasion he overheard Delphine Roberts tell Bannister that she saw Oswald on a street corner handing out pro-Castro material. Bannister then responded, quote, "Don't worry about him. He's a nervous fellow. He's confused. He's with us. He's associated with this office." Similarly, George Higginbotham, another one of Bannister's investigators, saw Oswald and another guy handing out leaflets in front of the International Trade Mart. We'll cover the exact details of this scenario in the next episode. When Higginbotham got back to Bannister's office, he told Bannister about Oswald and this other guy handing out pro-Castro material, to which Bannister responded, quote, "Cool it. One of them's mine." Jack Martin also said that Oswald had his own room to work out of at 544 Camp Street. This is consistent with what Delphine Roberts' daughter and Bill Nitschke said about seeing a lot of pro-Castro materials in one of the offices upstairs. Oswald wrote a letter to V.T. Lee, the head of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New York, saying that he had rented an office, even though he had been expressly told not to do that by V.T. Lee. If so, based on these witness statements, a great candidate for the office would be a room on the second floor of 544 Camp Street. If there's any credibility to what these witnesses are saying, it raises a huge red flag for anyone who's aware of Oswald's obsession with Marxism and the Soviet Union. To hear that Oswald may have been working for an anti-Castro person like Guy Bannister doesn't fit with the idea that he's out in the streets handing out pro-Castro materials. So what do Warren Report defenders say about all of this? First, not all of the materials that Oswald handed out were stamped 544 Camp Street. In fact, most were marked 4907 Magazine Street or with Oswald's P.O. Box. More importantly, as Gerald Posner points out, there was no lease in place with Lee Harvey Oswald or Fair Play for Cuba at 544 Camp Street. Sam Newman, the building's owner, said that he never saw Oswald and did not rent offices to Fair Play for Cuba. The five tenants of the building were asked if they recognized Oswald, and none of them did, nor did the janitor. But no one is arguing that Oswald had a written lease at 544 Camp Street. If you listen to the situation described by the witnesses, the claim is that there was an open office that was being used by Oswald on the second floor, not that he had a formal lease relationship with the landlord. So the lack of a lease doesn't necessarily undercut the witness testimony about Oswald using an office at 544 Camp Street. Another potential argument for why Oswald's use of 544 Camp Street is innocent is that the anti-Castro group, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, once rented office space at this same address, but moved out a year before Oswald began distributing the flyers. The fact that Oswald used the same address falsely must mean that he was trolling the Cuban Revolutionary Council. And the way Oswald could have known that their address was 544 Camp Street, even though they had moved out a year earlier before Oswald even lived in New Orleans, is that some of the Cuban Revolutionary Council's propaganda material still had the old 544 Camp Street address on it. As far as the 10 witnesses we covered who said that Oswald was in Bannister's office, for Warren Report defenders, all of them are unreliable. Similarly, the 6 people who said that Oswald used an office at 544 Camp Street or heard Bannister say that Oswald worked for him must be mistaken or lying. Now, it's true that Delphine Roberts and Jack Martin were both unsavory characters. Roberts was super racist and also gave inconsistent statements. And Jack Martin was definitely an alcoholic. If Roberts and Martin were the only ones who were connecting Oswald and Bannister, I could probably write it off as a simple exaggeration, or maybe they were lying. But there were many other witnesses, like Michael Kurtz, Vernon Gerdes, Tommy Baumler, David Lewis, William Gaudette, Mary Bringle, Bill Nitschke, Consuela Martin, Dan Campbell, Alan Campbell, and George Higginbotham. I can't just discount all of these witnesses as not being credible. And all of the witnesses who I just mentioned suggested in one way or another that Oswald had a working relationship with Guy Bannister. Now, if Warren Report critics were alleging that some random guy was having Oswald hand out these pro-Castro flyers, that might be harder to believe. But we're talking about Guy Bannister here. The idea of using Oswald to hand out pro-Castro materials fits with Bannister's practice of hiring college-age students to infiltrate college leftist groups. And monitoring and infiltrating leftist groups is exactly what Guy Bannister did during his career with the FBI and with his detective agency in New Orleans. Next time on Solving JFK, we turn our attention to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and continue to look for clarity about exactly what Oswald was doing when he was handing out this literature for Fair Play for Cuba. Was Oswald a Marxist fanatic who wanted to preach that worldview? Or was he being paid by Guy Bannister or someone else to make it look like he was intensely pro-Castro? If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, Or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.